Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. The 72nd Arkansas Writers Conference opens on Friday, June the 3rd, in the Crown Plaza Hotel, 201 South Shackelford Road in Little Rock. Yes, for 72 years, the conference has focused on Arkansas writers. I've had the privilege of interviewing some of the recent speakers brought in for the conference, and this year, the two highlighted are well known to me. Janice Kearney, who is being inducted into the Arkansas Writers Hall of Fame on Friday, June the 3rd, and Laura Parker Castoro, herself an inductee in 2005. She was already a best-selling novelist before moving back to Arkansas and joining the Arkansas Writers Conference. Laura is to be keynote speaker on Saturday, June the 4th. Today, she is my guest and joins me by phone as we talk first about Janice Kearney.
I've been involved with him for about 14 years, yeah.
But you were already a well-established author by the time you moved here, wasn't you?
Oh, yes.
So let's talk a little bit about Janice, and then we'll get back to talk about you.
Okay.
So Janice, have you known her for a long time as well?
I've known her probably 10 years, I would say. A good 10 years.
I was trying to remember when I first met her, and it was a fairly casual meeting over the phone to talk to her about various things she had been doing. And then I got closer to her with her connection with the Clintons, and then that remarkable period when she was the diary at the White House.
Right.
All the things.
We met after she had published that diary of the White House. It came out in the early 2000s, I'm trying to remember. And she came back to Arkansas, I think around 2005, 2006. That's why I'm saying I think I know her for about 10 years. I met her when she came back. First, she was speaking at the Clinton Library about the book that she had written about President Clinton. Yes. And so we met when she was speaking, and of course I bought a book and got her to sign it and everything, and that's how we met. And then she moved back to the Little Rock, up to the Arkansas, and became a member of Penn Women, and we actually spoke several times at the same kinds of programs, the Arkansas Literary Festival, UAPB, we both spoke at a library association there, so we kept running into each other, and we just kind of became friends. You sit and you talk and get to know one another, and she's a very interesting person.
Oh, yes, and like you, she has a way with words and obviously enjoys putting them together, and I loved her mystery novel. Did you read that?
I have not. I'm guilty on that. I always have this stack of books that I'm going to read that I haven't gotten to. But it got wonderful reviews, and I know my book club, I moved back to Texas before they read it, but it was on their agenda, and they loved it. I hear about things secondhand. So she can take what people might think of as ordinary things and tell the story in such a way that it becomes extraordinary.
Right.
And that's what gifted writers are able to do, storytellers, I should say, because some of them are oral and some of them are writers. They can take the ordinary and make it extraordinary, as she did with her own family story, which for the rest of us, when we heard it, it was extraordinary. But I've heard her talk and said, this is the way I grew up, and I thought that was ordinary. She has that gift.
Well, you and I met through one of your books, Crossing the Line.
That was in 2002, yes.
And the difficulty you had growing up with green eyes, red hair, and freckles, but seriously African-American.
Yes.
And how you were not accepted and how hurtful that was. And you've been writing, of course, just for the sheer pleasure of it for many years. And you suddenly, a couple of years ago, took on a pen name and a different series. And I wondered if that was why you chose the pen name, because it was so different.
Yes, actually, I have written both historical romance, I wrote contemporary, I wrote women's fiction, which is stories about families and relationships and that kind of thing. And I even wrote westerns at one point under two names. I wrote as Laura Parker, a romance, and then Laura Castoro, women's fiction. And now I'm writing something called romantic suspense. It's not the old-fashioned romantic suspense. It's a more edgy, more kind of in-your-face popular. It's a more popular kind of suspense. It was not like what I was writing before, and I didn't want readers from before to think, pick up a Laura Parker book and expect one kind of thing and go, oh my goodness, she's using four-letter words. It was kind of a fair warning to the audience that it would be something different. And since then, my fifth book in that series, well, fourth book, I did a novella also. People now know that it's me writing as Dee Dee Ayers, so the need for a pen name was to separate what has gone before, because audiences have certain expectations, and readers have that right to, well, I pick up a book by this person, I really like it, the next book will be somewhat similar, and so you don't want to spend your money with one expectation.
But for you, have you noticed a difference in your on the people who write fan books or comments about your new series with your new name?
They're younger. they're definitely fans of animals. The series that I'm writing is about canine handlers and their dogs. So every book features a different team, whether it's a police officer and his canine dog, patrol dog, or the most recent book that's out now is a canine handler with a search and rescue dog. So I try to highlight the kinds of, if you can say professional dogs, but certainly professional dog teams and what the dogs can do, incorporate that into the story. So I have a lot of dog lovers and a very knowledgeable audience, and I think part of that is because everybody gets online now, and it's so easy to just Facebook, you know, send a message or write on somebody's Facebook. Certainly email's been around for a good while, and writers, readers are more willing to give their opinion. And I've been extremely fortunate. I've had a lot of really, really good response to the new series. And you always worry because I'm not a canine handler, and I've always had a dog, but I've not been an expert of any kind. Done a ton of research for this series. Met a lot of wonderful people who work really hard and some very clever dogs. And it's just amazing. It's amazing what these dogs and their trainers together can accomplish.
Oh, life indeed.
Ordinary.
Now, this Arkansas conference, the 72nd Arkansas Writers Conference.
72 years. Isn't that amazing?
And you are a keynote speaker.
Yeah.
There are two or three of you, aren't there, who have that listing?
But you're two of us. Dusty Richards is speaking on Friday morning, and I'm speaking on Saturday.
And is this the first time you've been asked to come and be a keynote speaker?
I was asked maybe 4 years ago. It's always an extraordinary honor because there is the presumption that you have something important to say. And doing a keynote is a little different than doing workshops and all,
mm-hmm.
because you're speaking to all writers who attend, and the hope is that you say something that is useful to all of them as writers. So there's an inspirational element to keynotes, and just share the story of being a writer. You know what it's like, and what. How we're all really the same, you know, that we all run scared and then we all do this or that. And here's some tips about, you know, how it might be useful, that might be useful to you as you go along, or what I've learned, you know.
But I noticed that you are giving a sort of session on the Friday morning.
I am. I am doing a workshop, and that's about getting your work out there, things that you might not be told when you're turned down for whether you're trying to sell something to a magazine or to a publisher or even your own work. So many people are self-publishing these days and very successfully, but there are stumbling blocks that you may not see because no one will say anything to you, but here's things that you need to look for and how to interpret what is being said to find out if you're not getting where you want to be. These are the things you might want to check on.
So when you're the keynote speaker and you start off with your preamble or whatever it is, the shape of what you're going to say, is there then a chance formally to stop and have people ask questions, or do you have people who can't wait when you've said something to have an answer for that question?
Well, that works both ways. Usually with a speech, there's a question and answer, you know, a keynote speech, there's a question and answer period after, which I love because it gives me a chance to reiterate something, or if I have been said something incorrect or was misunderstood or whatever, that's always a good opportunity to say actually what I meant to say was. But those are always fun, and in my workshops, because I try to be interactive with that, then we get to I have a back and forth as I speak, as I go along, because I think the most important thing, beside telling somebody how to do something, is making sure that they understand what you're talking about. So the back and forth is always helpful, I find, to clarify on both ends, both what I said and what the person heard.
And I could see how some of the people who might have been at the first session, the give and take, and remembered something while they were listening to you giving the keynote, to come up and to come out with a question that refers back to what you said then rather than what you've just said for the keynote speech.
Well, that's okay, as long as I can remember what I said then. I like to talk about writing. It's one of those things that it's what I do, and I have a great enthusiasm for it. So I always like to hear what people have to say and to share what I've learned, and sometimes it's a fair amount, and I've been at this a good while, but I'm also learning all the time. The publishing industry has changed dramatically, just almost incredibly different. It's a whole different animal than it was even 10 years ago. It's certainly 20 or 30 years ago. So, but in the last 5 years, it has been kind of turned upside down by self-publishing, by online purchasing, the idea that people don't go into bookstores to buy books anymore. And how, as a writer, do you find those people to say, hey, I have a book out, maybe you'd like to read it if you knew it was available? So from the top to bottom, the industry has changed utterly.
Have the people that you deal with, agents and such, have they changed much? Have you had to change?
I have changed, not my agent. We've been together I sold my first book myself, but since my first book, she and I have been together, which is pretty rare. But we've just had one of those long-term businesses. But editing has changed a lot. My editor's younger than my daughter, so there's that. I have a younger audience, and so I have to make sure that my language stays contemporary, not use the old cliches and things. Writing sentences are shorter. There's more white space around writing, and there are things like that that sound strange, but people don't want to read densely packed paragraphs anymore, and things like that. So those are new skills. Some of that has come with the type of book that I'm writing. Suspense is quick and tight and should move along. That requires a slightly different set of writing skills than writing a historical romance, for instance, where you have the luxury and time to describe everything that's going along. So I'm always learning. Part of the craft is to stay contemporary because the audiences are contemporary. And you don't want anybody to say, oh, well, she's been writing a long time because... No. So, yes, I do a lot of keeping up myself. I do. Yeah.
That was Laura Castoro, best-selling, well-known novelist, and for this Arkansas Writers' Conference, keynote speaker on Saturday, June the 4th. Her latest books, Mysteries with Canine Partners, are published under the pen name D.D. Ayers by St. Martin's Paperbacks. Festivals are bursting out all over, it seems. Concerts, theatres, and everything related, and graduation has set its seal on the educational. Now, the Hot Springs Music Festival runs June 5th to 18th, the Arkansas Shakespeare Festival, June 10th to July 9th, Wildwood Academy for Music and the Arts, WAMA, June 12th through July 24th, Theatre Squared's New Play Festival, June 17th through 26th, Opera in the Ozarks, June 17th to July 15th. Here at the Art Scene, we start with the first, in Hot Springs with the Music Festival, and music director Peter Bay. He has led the festival the past 5 years, and it is now in its 21st season. The festival is so firmly set that the programs seem almost to arrange themselves. So Maestro Bay leads us through the two-week festival with the programming and some of the artists who will mentor the apprentices who come to discover what it means to be a professional musician.
These are all either professional musicians in major orchestras or they are professors at major universities. For example, Scott Moore, who is going to be one of the soloists this year, he is the principal trumpeter of the Memphis Symphony. And Annie Chalix Boyle, who is going to be the soloist on the first program, playing the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, she is professor at Texas Tech University. It's a wide range of backgrounds these mentors come from.
And it's been quite a while since the first festival opened, and
yeah.
Those early apprentices, are some of them coming back as mentors?
You know, there have been some. Osiris, who is our clarinet mentor, Molina, he is a former apprentice, as is Jenny Mann, the bassoon mentor. She's also a former apprentice, so there are a few of those.
What have you done, or what has the festival done, after that old hotel burned?
I think most of the concerts were certainly moved to other places. For example, the opening night is always held at the Arlington Hotel Ballroom. But then the other concerts have been in several churches, namely St. Luke's Episcopal Church and the First Presbyterian Church, which is very close to the hotels that had burned. And then the other main venue is the Oak Lawn Magnet School, a former middle school, just a few blocks away from the racetrack. But it has a very fine auditorium and perfect for our orchestral needs.
Is it also used to house some of the apprentices when they come?
The apprentices and many of the mentors are housed at the brand new dorms that are at the Math and Science School.
Ah.
Yes, a new dorm was built, I want to say, 3 years ago, so we have been occupying that.
And that's within good walking distance of all the places they should be when they're rehearsing and practicing and playing?
Yes, all but the Oak Lawn Magnet School, which is a bit of a walk. That's a good 10 minutes drive from downtown, so most of them carpool.
Of course.
Right.
Or bring bicycles. One of the things that I remember were the slightly offbeat concerts.
We're concentrating a little bit more with the standard repertoire, but having said that, there are a lot of pieces that are from composers who are not that familiar, but who wrote very, very fine music, and you hear most of those on the chamber music concerts.
There's a lot of interest in the new composers, the young composers up and coming, and some of them are doing extraordinarily well. And are you taking on some of those?
Oh, yeah, there are bits and pieces of those kinds of works strewn throughout the summer. In fact, one concert on June the 15th, which will be at the Oak Lawn, will feature the percussion ensemble, mostly the apprentices with Matthew McClung as their mentor and their conductor. They're playing two works by Steve Reich, who is celebrating his 80th birthday this year. There will be a work by Alan Hovhaness, who, while is not a young composer, is still a relatively unknown composer in the United States for unknown reasons.
Except for that one piece.
The Mysterious Mountain, right?
Yes.
And there's, he wrote a piece about whales that includes whale songs, and God created great whales. That's played a lot, but other than that, you don't hear much. So we're going to play a piece of his. We're celebrating the centenary of Alberto Ginastera, the great Argentinian composer. So there'll be three or four works this summer played in his honor.
After the opening fanfare, what happens the first week that you consider outstanding, that you really would like everybody to be there for?
Well, certainly the first orchestral concert, which takes place on Thursday the 9th, that will include an overture by Ginastera called the Overture to the Creole Faust. And what Ginastera has done is taken some melodies from Gounod's Faust and wrap them into an Argentinian Latin flavor. And it's quite an exciting piece, and I'm very glad we're going to play it. And that's the opening work on that program. As I mentioned earlier, our violin mentor, one of them anyway, Annie Chalex-Boyle, she's going to play the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. We also have the famous Moldau of Smetana on that program. And to conclude the rather international flavor of that concert is the second three-cornered hat suite by Manuel de Falla. A little bit of everything, yeah.
Yes.
And also that week we have chamber music featuring the Cavell Trio, which is for clarinet, bassoon, and oboe trio. We have solo works by two of our new mentors, horn and cello. More chamber music on Tuesday the 7th, on which I will conduct a suite from L'Histoire du Soldat of Stravinsky. All the players in the ensemble are our mentors, so they'll set a great example for the apprentices, though, who are there.
It's a very effective piece, that.
And the rest of that week will feature a wide variety of chamber pieces. There was one program that's all French, Debussy, Devienne, Saint-Saëns, Ibert. There'll be some Mozart, some Dvorak that first week, and it just gets better and better from there.
You haven't branched out in any kind of vocal ensemble performing piece sort of breaks with opera and things like that?
Well, not this year, but what we do have in the second week is a concert that'll feature the festival chorus under Lynn Payette's direction. And she's chosen two short pieces of Mozart, the famous Ave Verum Corpus, and also a piece I've never even heard live. It's the Veni Sancte Spiritus. Again, that's for chorus and small orchestra, and I've asked Lynn to be the conductor for those works.
And that will be held in the
Oak Lawn Magnet School, and the date for that will be Tuesday the 14th of June.
How big are the orchestras for these pieces that you've been mentioning?
Well, for the Mozart works, they'll be rather small. I'd say no more than 40 players, perhaps even fewer. The largest work that we're doing this summer, which is going to be on the closing concert on June the 18th, that's a Saturday evening, is the Fifth Symphony of Mahler. And there'll be close to 100 players performing that night. And it's a massive work. I don't know if this festival has ever played the piece before, so we're very excited about playing Mahler's Fifth there.
Well, like Wagner, Mahler never wrote something really short.
No, just some songs, but they're usually packaged together to make a 20 to 25 minute piece.
So,
Mahler's Fifth is a good 70 minutes of playing.
Oh, wow. Now, getting back to some of the individuals who'll be playing, being brought out of the throng, as you might say. Soloists, you've got some of the mentors taking over that role in a number of pieces. What about the apprentices? Do they have an opportunity to be a soloist in a piece that's
Soloists, not necessarily. Most of the apprentices take part in chamber ensembles, so a minimum of duets, trios, quartets, larger ensembles like the Dvorak Wind Serenade. However, we do have several programs in the course of the 2 weeks which are called potpourri concerts, in which they audition early in the summer to play on these concerts, and they could be a flute and piano duet. It could be a solo work like a Bach suite on either the violin, cello, or viola. It could be a brass ensemble. It could be anything. And we don't even know what those works are yet.
So where are they put in terms of the programming?
They are placed, most of them are, well, they're on the two Fridays of the festival. There are two Fridays in the festival, and the dates would be the 10th and the 17th. Mm-hmm. And that's when these potpourri concerts take place.
Where?
At the First Presbyterian Church, and that's in the heart of downtown, right just a few blocks from the Arlington Hotel.
Now, you used to have, at the very beginning, each festival, they'd have somebody painting something in a gallery and a musician either improvising something or playing something that was appropriate for the painting. Do you still do that?
You know, I don't believe we're doing that this year. However, we are playing in the farmer's market in Hot Springs on Orange Street.
Mm-hmm.
There very well may be some other concerts arranged in art galleries throughout the town, but some of those are done rather spontaneously. But the major programs are either in the churches or at the Oak Lawn.
No bathhouses?
No bathhouses this year.
Have you ever considered that the Hot Springs Music Festival could have mentors and apprentices for conducting?
Well, we do have apprentices for conducting, and we have a very talented young man named Alex Amzel who basically won the audition. The auditions usually are through video, and I think I received 30 or so auditions, and very fine conductors, young conductors. But Alex rose to the top, and I'm delighted that he's going to help me this summer, and he will have a chance to conduct on the same program as the chorus, and he will also conduct a work on one of the chamber concerts. He will do the Dvorak Wind Serenade.
Oh, lovely.
We do have an apprentice, which I call an assistant conductor, every year.
Okay, so that's been catered to for a good number of years.
Indeed. I think that's been a feature of the festival since the very first one.
Have any of them gone on to take that on as a career successfully?
I think many of them have. In fact, the assistant that we had last year, Jessica Morell, took a university position, and I think she's in line for several professional orchestras as well as an assistant.
That sounds very satisfying, I would think, for you.
Absolutely. It is very satisfying. It's so difficult to get a career in conducting underway, and it requires a lot of patience, a lot of talent, and a bit of luck. But usually the conductors that we see come to the festival have had great success elsewhere. They were good enough to get into the festival in the first place, so they're talented to carry on their careers afterwards.
Now, what have we not talked about?
I think we've covered nearly everything. I can't think of another thing. We're just very excited to get underway. Like I said, the first concert will be on Sunday, the 5th of June.
I know, it's coming up soon.
14 days of concerts.
Peter Bay, music director for the Hot Springs Music Festival. For information, visit hotmusic.org or call 501-623-4963. The festival opens June the 5th with the traditional concert on the Arlington Hotel Terrace. For concert and open rehearsal schedules, visit hotmusic.org/2016-concerts. Ticket information, hotmusic.org, or call 501-623-4763. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.